good horse, I call you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're listening to episode 581 of Unwelcome Guests, Unmasking the Genocide of Business as Usual. I'm Robin Upton. In our second hour this week, I'm going to continue reading from David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years, about how debt is used to frame acts of violence and domination relationships. He's going to be looking in particular at why, given the wide range of patterns of human interaction, do people, particularly in the modern world, tend to frame everything as exchange. Deep background there on the ongoing economic globalization, which we're going to be looking at in more detail in our first hour this week. Thank you to Sibel Edmonds and Peter B. Collins for their good work in producing the Boiling Frogs podcast. This is episode 34, interviewing Professor of Globalization Anthony J. Hall, author of Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism. In this wide-ranging interview, he's going to be looking at the history of globalization for the last 500 years and its consequences measured out not only in shattered lives, destroyed societies and ecosystems, but increasingly in damage to what we might call the American soul. Asking, for example, why it is that Americans simply accept that their every move is being spied on by a highly armed hierarchy which seems to have no compunction about killing people when it deems necessary. Why do Americans put up with the war on terror? Why don't they oppose taking away of legal safeguards such as habeas corpus or the right to a trial by jury? This interview was carried out in 2010, and my interpretation of the Occupy movement is that enough is enough. And increasingly, Americans will be concerning themselves not only with the narrow consumer world, but with the larger world and with the consequences of their actions and the actions of their supposedly elected officials. And the next voice you hear is that of Peter B. Collins.
Professor, give us an overview of your work, because as an expert on globalization, and in particular as a non-American, I think you offer our listeners here in the United States a very important perspective.
Earth into Property is the second volume of The Bowl with One Spoon. And in it, I begin with the concept of globalization since 1492, that the modern era of globalization really begins when Christopher Columbus begins the conquest of the so-called New World. And out of this imperial globalization, which continues to this day, the U.S. empire, with the Pentagon really as the central focus and the CIA, you know, continues this empire often through informal means, covert means, but it really is continuing a trajectory of history that goes back centuries. And in the light of imperial globalization, indigenous peoples around the world, and I begin with North America or the Western Hemisphere, but this concept of indigenous peoples, I think three-quarters of the people on the planet are indigenous peoples, indigenous to Africa, indigenous to Asia, people who have seen empires coming primarily from Western Europe coming at them, not as a force of expanded opportunity, but as a force that is preempting their indigenous ways, their languages, their laws, narrowing their horizons, a kind of implosion. So I have referred to the efforts of indigenous people to resist imperial globalization as anti-imperial globalization, whether it be, you know, the pan-Arab movement, the pan-Indian movement in North America, pan-African movement. People have had to envisage themselves in larger and larger ways to resist the force of imperialism, which, you know, was genocidal in the Western Hemisphere. At Bandung Conference in 1955, for instance, all the representatives of indigenous peoples met to say, in the Cold War, you know, what are we going to do? The old imperialism of Europe is being replaced by the superpower bipolar imperialism of the Cold War, and this is preempting us from, you know, realizing our self-government, our democracy, our own indigenous ways of being and doing and going into the future. So that, in a nutshell, is a big picture of what the book, or the two books, really are about.
And your new book is fascinating. I've only managed to read a couple of key chapters, and it is encyclopedic in its scope. And I do want to recommend it to people. And before we end the interview, I'd like you to give us information on how they could acquire it from the McGill Queen's University Press. And I started with your second chapter, where you trace the history of imperialism, starting with the Crusades and focusing on the so-called discoveries of the Americas, and the really the development of commerce in the United States, related first to gold and silver, then luxury goods in the fur trade, addictive substances from sugar to tobacco, the slave trade, that which was a very important component of the development of the United States commercial system, and not to leave out the massive genocide of Native Americans that was a part of the manifest destiny of white Europeans on this continent. And I don't want to give short shrift to the scope of your work, but for the purposes of our conversation, let's start at the end of World War II, when major industries in the United States, including the automotive industries, had been converted during wartime to really state-controlled manufacturing and marketing systems. And that as we came out of the Second World War and moved into the lengthy Cold War, which you called bipolar imperialism, we saw the introduction of the national security state, or at least the massive expansion. And, of course, in my lifetime, I do see it as the inception of that. And this has led to the expansion of American political interests side by side with the commercial interests of American corporations. And in many respects, it's very hard to separate the two or to define separate interests, that our foreign policy and the tactics of our intelligence communities were all focused on the advancement of American corporate interests in expanding markets and the acquisition of resources worldwide. So if you could start from there, and we, of course, want to focus in short order on the recent past and the solidification, in many respects, of these interests in a way that has appalled many Americans and leaves many of us wondering if we can ever unravel it.
Yes, Peter. Of course, World War II itself, the big American corporations were on, many of them were on both sides of the Second World War. Ford was an early fan of and promoter of and supporter of Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler had his picture up in his Munich office. Ford developed, how did the Third Reich develop the machinery, the financial know-how, the wherewithal to do what it did to become such an engine of conquest. And it was U.S. companies, Ford Company, then General Motors with Opel, then IBM. Of course, people will have read Edwin Black's IBM and the Holocaust. These U.S. corporations played, you know, both sides of the street, as it were, and in a way they were much more pleased with the German approach to capitalism than Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And these companies experienced World War II on both sides. Let's remember that the Third Reich was built up primarily to oppose the expansion of Soviet communism into Central Europe. And so the capitalist class, of course, saw in Hitler a defense, a bastion of defense against the expansion of Soviet-style communism. So coming out of the Second World War, these companies had experiences on both sides. Standard Oil, the Rockefeller company, was a big part of IG Farben. IG Farben started a place called Auschwitz, which began as a factory for producing airplane fuel from coal. So it was a privatized effort. So after World War II, of course, the United States had all the gold. Its industry was intact. Europe was decimated. Japan was decimated. And it was a moment of great power for the United States. And the permanent war economy that had begun in 1941 after the invasion of Pearl Harbor, the decision was made to simply continue it and to subsidize the big companies through the military-industrial complex. Some have called this military Keynesianism. So the companies that had participated on both sides of World War II, the CIA was created in 1947 with the National Security Act, and this was this act had as its basis the idea that the Soviet Union, which had been an ally during the Second World War, would no longer be an ally. And in fact, many of the anti-communist apparatchiks of the Nazi regime were incorporated into the national security state of the United States. And so the development of U.S. corporations, of course, the big infusion of capital from the Defense Department has given, you know, the research and development arms of these companies a huge boost, huge government taxpayer subsidies. And those companies, of course, went on to dominate the world commercially, but also sort of culturally and politically. And in the name of the Cold War, in the name of anti-communism, these companies' interests were promoted by the military in a country, for instance, like Congo, which theoretically became self-governing in 1960. The first premier they chose was a man called Patrice Lumumba. He, like many of the other indigenous leaders of the time, wanted to nationalize the natural resources, which in Congo are hugely lucrative. This was not to be accepted. The idea that self-government would extend to the economy was not accepted by these global corporations. Patrice Lumumba was assassinated. We saw the same trajectory in Indonesia, in many parts of the Western Hemisphere, in Chile, for instance, where Allende was removed. And so in the name of national security, the interests of U.S. corporations was made to prevail, primarily U.S. corporations, also some based in Europe, some based in Japan, the trilateral set there. And of course, with 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, suddenly there's no enemy. And so an enemy has to be invented or constructed in order to continue this permanent war economy that has been going full speed, sucking up more and more of the political economy of the United States since 1941. And since 9/11, of course, it continues to become huge. It's a leviathan, and it really shrinks and overwhelms all the rest of the economy and dominates it. So really what happens at the ballot box is kind of secondary to the prerogatives and imperatives of these corporate oligarchies, which have become, you know, huge leviathans, in a way, promoters of monopoly capitalism. They really don't like competition.
Mm-hmm. And in that narrative, I didn't hear you really include the financial sector, starting with Brown Brothers Harriman, who financed part of the Nazi war machine. And that, of course, is the ancestry of the Bush family that I still find it hard to believe that we've had a Bush dynasty develop in this country.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, the investment was being funneled from the United States through Wall Street into Germany. And so that's very well recorded.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, also the development of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund as instruments of the projection of American-style capitalism. And you have a blurb on the back of your book from your fellow Canadian, Naomi Klein. Her book, Shock Doctrine, I think, describes the sequence of events there and the power of these two repositories of money used as leverage to dismantle indigenous structures such as trade unions and tariff systems in nations that run into financial turbulence or currency collapse or U.S. orchestrated assassination or other destabilization programs. And that, I think, has been a very powerful instrument of the expansion of American-based global imperialism.
Yes, of course, part of what made the United States so powerful after the Second World War was the reality that the U.S. currency was the strongest in the planet. It had gold backing it. And so the advantage to the United States and its banking sector of having the U.S. currency as the world currency of exchange, this has been enormous. Now, of course, 1971, U.S. is off the gold standard, and the Arab oil embargo in 1973, I see this as a really key moment. Behind the scenes, Nixon was making a deal with the Saudis, essentially saying, we'll let you and the other OPEC companies increase the price of oil maybe 400%, but the key is that the U.S. dollar is going to be the global currency. In other words, if you want to buy oil, you have to buy it in U.S. dollars. So this gave the, I'm calling it the Saudi-American petrodollars, a sort of new life, a new strength. But the reality was that once the Saudis were partners in such an integral way, the focus shifted to sort of pipelines in Eurasia, drug deals in Eurasia, the kind of deals that the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, mm-hmm. Pakistani-based, Lahore-based bank. You know, if you want to understand the privatized terror economy these days, a good place to start is looking at that BCCI bank.
Indeed.
And the U.S. Sort of lost interest in manufacturing, in companies like General Motors, which, you know, had been the marvel of sort of regulated capitalism. The Treaty of Detroit is sometimes referred to in 1951. You know, the auto workers got a good deal. They actually got a, you know, part of the pie, as it were, a bigger part of the pie. And there was a kind of period of fairly good in, health in industrial relations. Labor unions got so deeply integrated into the economy, in fact, that Jimmy Hoffa, you know, they were right in the involved in all the mafia and covert activities. But after 1973, it was as if a whole new regime sets in, and at the highest ends of the financial sector and the banking sector, it's sort of a well, let's not bother to, you know, make cars and put our attention there. Let's get into regime change in Eurasia, building pipelines, working with the Saudis in these kind of covert deals. And I think AIG, the insurance giant that so supposedly insurance giant that was emerged as sort of the key player in the financial debacle, and all the bailout monies was sort of funneled through AIG to pay back the counterparties. You know, it was definitely deeply involved in the national security state. And, you know, to say these derivative products, and it's somewhat complex to discuss what they are, but yeah. I've been told, you know, all about subprime mortgages. And
well, you have a line in your book that explains it simply. It's bets on bets on bets. And I like to play a little craps in a casino. And in craps, you can bet with the shooter or against the shooter. And there are many ways that you leverage your bets with odds and so forth.
And you hedge your bets. You play both sides.
Correct.
And so, you know, you had these derivative products with, I'm sure it was war game software, where you kind of look at every possible combination. You think of, you know, what could happen if this happens, then respond with this. You know, hedge your bets in every way. So these computer programs that are buying and selling on various markets according to these pre-programmed, you know, the software, once these went into the actual economy, the real economy, they eventually just pulled it on down. But I'm saying that the derivatives, I don't think that the derivatives are exclusively to do with subprime mortgages, housing markets in the United States. I'm sure many of these derivative products are connected to, you know, different scenarios for building pipelines in Eurasia, getting at that Caspian oil, removing this regime or that regime, making this drug deal or that drug deal. You know, it's very important to understand how central drug dealing, illicit drug dealing, is in empire building since the days of the Opium Wars.
Mm-hmm.
So these derivative products, we haven't been told the full story of how these derivatives are connected to bets on bets on bets in the national security state and what it does in all over the world.
And Professor Hall, if you would, let's put it in the context of the Bush Wars of Choice. And putting aside for a moment whether one believes the official story, what I call the mythology, of the events of September 11, 2001, we know that prior to that, the Bush administration was focusing on Iraq and taking out Saddam Hussein, that Dick Cheney's secret energy task force was meeting to look at world oil reserves, and that this was part of a larger scheme to really expand the American empire and its dominance well into this current new century. And so talk a little bit about your perspective on the provocations of 9/11 used to propel the U.S. into wars in both Afghanistan and Iraq, which are now Obama's wars, and that's where we'll get to in just a few minutes.
Yeah, well, let's look at the big picture here. Since 1941, the United States has propelled, you know, much of its treasury, its resources, its creativity into what Dwight Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. And, you know, that involves the militarization of space, Trident submarines, you know, infiltrating all the governments of the world, doing regime changes, invasions sometimes, developing chemical weapons, and on and on and on. And all of this could be justified as long as the Soviet Union was there. And, you know, thinking back growing up in the Cold War, how brainwashed we were and how we were made to feel this imperiled condition, how dangerous the Soviet Union was, how it was, you know, if we weren't vigilant, it was going to take us over. And then suddenly, one day to the next, it seemed to me, it's no longer. The Berlin Wall comes down, and there is the United States with all its commitment to this permanent war economy. So what are you going to do about an enemy? How can you justify, how can you call on taxpayers to continue funding this whole apparatus, which, as we know, serves, you know, a very small number of people in a huge, huge way? And so an enemy was needed. And lo and behold, on 9/11, a new enemy appeared or was made to appear. And, you know, there was this... it's hard not to think of it as a psychological operation, this series of pictures, a live snuff film, if you will, that so terrified people, that was so gruesome in its spectacle, almost, you know, you could imagine Madison Avenue people designing such a spectacle. And let's remember that this permanent war economy, some of the big contracts go to Madison Avenue to sell war. That's the most lucrative thing to sell after you sell toothpaste and presidents and whatnot, selling war. Remember Hill and Knowlton and the little babies from the incubator being smashed into the ground by Saddam Hussein's people? It turned out to be complete fraud.
Well, I do remember that very well, Professor. Let me just add that I was snookered by Hill and Knowlton with the story of the girl from Kuwait who talked about babies being dumped out of incubators and that sort of thing. And so I still have a bit of a bruise from that particular episode. I was doing a daily talk show on a radio station in San Francisco, and while I didn't believe the story at the time, I didn't have the wherewithal to disprove it.
Yeah. So, you know, so that invasion was based on a lie, a completely fraudulent creation of Hill and Knowlton, who should, you know, somebody should be in jail for that. We know that the invasion of Iraq was based on this assertion that Saddam Hussein had or was about to have weapons of mass destruction, the media have sort of fallen on the sword and said, well, that wasn't true and we should have done our homework. But some of us who looked at it long and hard have reason to believe that the lies about weapons of mass destruction is just entry-level lies, that the lies surrounding 9/11, and it really, there really isn't one part of the official story that stands up to scrutiny. There's not one, you know, from the how the buildings fell to how, why the planes didn't go out to what happened at the Pentagon to what happened with Flight 93 to who were the 19 Saudi dudes with box cutters and are they still alive or not, and on and on. I haven't really been able to find one part of the official conspiracy theory that holds up. But somehow this mythology that you're creating, this U.S. penchant for creating smoke and mirrors, creating dreams, the Hollywood dream machine, understanding how psychology works and being able to manipulate public opinion, it's been done in such a way that it justifies these never-ending wars. Barack Obama, who generated such hope, has bought into these Bushite fables and given this mythology that it was all planned in caves with flashlights in Afghanistan, which just happened to conveniently be where the major pipelines are being planned. So Canada is in Afghanistan. I don't think it would look very good on Prime Minister Harper to say, yeah, we're in Afghanistan to secure the ground for the pipelines. Instead, we get this increasingly disreputable, discredited story about what happened on 9/11. It's well documented that it isn't what they said it is. Then you get into the alternative theories. I don't, we don't have all the information, but I would certainly say suspect number one would be Dick Cheney.
Professor, in your book, you bring together two pivotal figures and you compare them. And here's a quote: those responsible for packaging Barack Obama drew unashamedly from the pictographic heritage of Che, and this is Ernesto Che Guevara, legend, as they mounted perhaps the world's most successful ever advertising campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because it also goes into the marketing and the packaging and the branding scheme that you're talking about.
Yes, of course, Che Guevara was a hero of the Cuban Revolution. He wasn't content to be Minister of Finance in Havana, and he went off to Congo, Africa, in 1965. I was there in 1971, and I begin the book by reflecting on the reality that, hey, Che Guevara was here trying to export the Cuban Revolution to that part of the world and to preempt the coming to power of Mobutu. Desiré Mobutu became Sese Seko, who was a kleptocrat, who was a dictator, who killed and tortured his opponents, like most of the U.S. client regimes do around the world in resource-rich regions. It occurred to me that Barack Obama's father, a Luo man, he came from that same area. So here I was traveling in a region where there's involvement of Che Guevara, who was martyred in Bolivia eventually in 1967 and sort of became this icon of revolutionary resistance to imperialism. And this imagery of Che was appropriated by the advertising agencies and the public relations people who sold us this product called Barack Obama, the perfect postmodern person. He's black, he's white, he's African, he's indigenous, he's Cherokee, he's rich, he's poor, Barack Obama clearly is able to play on the fact that he can be a chameleon, he can appear to be so many things. And there was an incredible coming together of various techniques of advertising. He is a very attractive person, an individual, and he was able to con us, I guess, and make us believe that there was a person there who was willing to take a stand on things rather than a manufactured product who is sort of owned bought and paid for by the military-industrial complex and the bankers of Wall Street, the, you know, real axis of, well, I'd have to say evil these days. Look at the axis between Wall Street and the Pentagon, which is, you know, hugely lucrative channel of communications, which benefit, you know, a small number of people tremendously. So, you know, as soon as Barack Obama took power, we could see he was not cutting back the military-industrial complex, not trying to put checks on the Pentagon, but in fact, you know, increased the public funding for the military-industrial complex. You know, he had no capacity or no will, it seemed, to regulate Wall Street, change the players. You know, he was clearly subject to some kind of control from the same people responsible for developing within the system such a grotesque kleptocracy where CEOs, essentially deregulation was exploited in a way to enable you know, a few to even steal an appropriate from shareholders, from pensioners, from and the whole system broke down under Bush. And, you know, as a result of these bailouts, I think you have the biggest transfer of wealth from middle-class people, from people who pay taxes, to people who often don't pay taxes because they have their monies offshore. And, you know, you have this historic transfer of wealth up the scale, and Barack Obama is, you know, dealing with some window dressing and a little bit of you know, regulatory this and that, but the same players responsible for the mess are in charge, and clearly Obama is their puppet.
And Professor, you have an interesting take on the socialization of the losses incurred under the so-called free market system. And I'd like you to talk about that for a moment, because I think this is a very important aspect of this merger of the corporate interests with the government. And as you let me just offer a quick quote from the book where you say, as Kevin Baker has explained, Obama seemed in the early stages of his presidency to be captive to the same clique of Wall Street power brokers who had created the conditions of the financial crisis in the first place. This tendency is well illustrated by the Obama administration's massive commitment of federal funds to keep alive AIG's dubious pyramid schemes of derivative betting with counterparties. The U.S. government's continuation of these schemes expresses and perpetuates some of the worst lies and contradictions of Reaganomics. It ties the leadership of the U.S. executive branch to the legacies of false conservatism that serves the private interests of a few rather than the public interests of the many. For conservatism to be genuine, it must serve the public interest rather than violate it.
Yes, well, you know, this Tea Party movement is very sort of disturbing yet hilarious to watch. The people in the Tea Party imagine themselves as conservatives, but of course in the Civil War in British North America that resulted in the creation of the United States, the founders of Canada were on the conservative side. And, of course, this is getting into the deeper history that I talk about in my book. But, after all, in the American Revolution, my country, Canada, comes out of the conservative side of that equation. And I know that the founders of my country wanted to make treaties with indigenous people, incorporate Indians into the British Empire on the basis of law and the basis of consent. And the founders of the United States were, you know, sort of imperialists in a hurry, didn't want to deal with the indigenous people in the interior and let manifest destiny prevail. Let's just march westward, and if genocide occurs, so be it. And this is our manifest destiny. God has given us this destiny to prevail not only in North America now, but increasingly around the world. So, you know, the rhetoric of the war on terror, with, you know, plays on these old themes of savagery and civilization. Only these days we're going back to, well, we have to go and murder these people, and you know, because it's bringing democracy, it's bringing enlightenment. You know, in the old days it was bringing Christianity, it was bringing civilization to the savages. We're back into that kind of rhetoric, And, of course, you know, the United States developed in a way that a very, very small clique ended up owning the vast majority of the wealth. That small clique backed Adolf Hitler in World War II. And through the National Security Act and the creation of the CIA, Alan Dulles, for instance, the first director of the CIA, incorporated many of the Nazi spy rings, the anti-communist psychological warfare, the scientists, Wernher von Braun, and on, into this system of U.S. imperialism. Of course, in the British Empire, there was some sort of rule of law to imperial expansion. With the Pentagon as the imperial capital of the world, in a sense, you know, the Pentagon doesn't run according to laws and, you know, it has internal policies, but there's nothing democratic about it. It's kind of laissez-faire empire. We'll do what the British did, only we won't bind ourselves with rules and such. We'll just do it covertly. And, you know, the people of the world are just getting disgusted with this. And, you know, the unpopularity of the United States, the way that people resent the way that all of our self-government and self-determination is undermined by the government, you could say, but really behind the government are this clique of corporations at the core of the military-industrial complex. And it's grotesque. It's just not acceptable.
Professor, the same corporations are also running the mainstream media, and this is where everything, information, gets to be packaged, branded, and sold to the public, and as part of this entire psychological warfare. And with this being the case, I mean, what can we even expect from the people in return?
Yes, this is a key concept to understand. In this day and age, the core institutions of the military-industrial complex are the media conglomerates, whether we're talking about, you know, CBS or Fox or ABC or Disney or Vivendi or a very small number of companies. If we're going to engage and put all the treasury into this global militarization, then people have to go along with it. People have to, their minds have to be prepared. For instance, when drones, these robots are going into Pakistan, clearing out whole valleys through, you know, terror, just indiscriminately bombing whole populations, and nobody really takes the responsibility because it's computer programmers back in Florida or something doing it. I mean, this is only possible if people back in the United States and Canada and Europe have the sense that those on the receiving end of these weapons, or whether it be Gaza, are not really fully human, that they're terrorists or they're harboring terrorism or their religion breeds terrorism. And so, you know, the contamination of our minds, we talk about environmental contamination. I don't think there's anything as disastrous to humanity at the moment as the way our minds have been contaminated by these media conglomerates who create these mythologies on which the war machine depends. And as I say, you know, it's not only the media conglomerates, there are public relations companies who design ad campaigns or public relations campaigns, so-called, for wars. You know, the Hill and Knowlton case is classic. And of course, 9/11, the way it's been portrayed, the interpretation given us within, you know, 2 or 3 hours, you know, has remained the same to this day, and it is calculated to produce, you know, a never-ending supply of enemies, and it kind of has demonized the entire Arab world, the entire Muslim world, and created a situation where we almost seem to be in religious wars, crusades in a way, and this is only possible through media manipulation, which has reached, you know, startling proportions, and you know, it's very difficult to work at a university these days, where, you know, you see so many individuals, professors, with privileged positions, with tenure, with good salaries, with, you know, protections, with faculty associations, and how many are willing to address, for instance, the geopolitical outcome of what happened on 9/11. Unless you get at the roots of what really happened on 9/11, if you just talk about the outgrowth or aftermath of it, you're really not doing your job. And so, you know, we're seeing a betrayal not only of our media, the mainstream media, but of our academics. Of course, in the Cold War, were, bought off. They were hired in droves as various kind of specialists. When Dwight Eisenhower identified the military-industrial complex as this very menacing thing, you know, just as he was retiring in 1961, he warned that the military-industrial complex was producing this technocracy and these corporate elites who were undermining democracy. And he referred specifically to the way the universities were being undermined and how free and open inquiry at the universities was being destroyed and curtailed as a result of the incorporation of so many faculty into the psychological warfare aspects and the technological warfare aspects of the military-industrial complex.
Right. With the media, but though, it also seems to be going both ways, because when we are talking with, you know, your average people here in the United States, I mean, you get to hear, you know, from their perspective, this is what we want. That's what they would tell you. We have a grim life, you know, so stressful. We are driving through all this rush hours and all the bills and the health care insurance, et cetera, et cetera. And the last thing we want is to come and face grim news. This is why we like to get our news from, let's say, Jon Stewart, and get more entertainment than news, because as if it is even willing on the on their side, because even when you present or you want to present them with the factual information and alternative news, they actually tend to look the other way. I started this project of collecting some of the pictures of our civilian casualties, you know, of what our military treats as collateral damage. And these are, you know, the burned bodies of 4 or 5 years old children, you know, women disfigured. And I put it together and I say, well, this is what we are doing in Afghanistan. I mean, you want to envision this terrorist-looking bearded guy in shalwar with Kalashnikov, but This is what we are doing. This is part of what we are paying with our taxes. This is what we are condoning. And they look the other way. It's like, I'd rather not to see. I really rather not look at this. I'd rather not know, because if I don't know, then I'm comfortable. And this is my comfort zone. But then when you talk with the media, they are telling me and others, well, we are giving the people what they want. They don't want the factual stuff. They don't want the reality. They do want the entertainment, and this is what we are delivering. We are basically supplying the demand, and the demand is, don't give me the grim stuff. I mean, what would you say to that?
Well, the dumbing down of the population is, extraordinary. The school system is not doing a good job for the vast majority of people. There is a small elite who get very good educations. The type of thing that we're doing right now, where we're talking about history, we're naming legislation, we're naming facts. In other words, we're trying to apply our reason and rationality to a consideration of what is going on. The media cartels don't work that way, and most people have been socialized now that it really doesn't work that way. It really doesn't matter. Many in the system or in the ruling class might think it really doesn't matter what the facts are, what the reality is. What matters is how people perceive it. And, you know, that was a classic with the Obama campaign about, you know, creating a set of perceptions. As we go about documenting what's actually going on, trying to, you know, prove our, you know, get sources, make sure that we empirically demonstrate with facts what we're saying. The big system that is selling war, it doesn't work on that level at all. They're selling mythology. They're selling imagery. They're selling perceptions. And so nowadays, you know, you just say certain buzzwords, you know, taxes, abortion, and you know, you can't have any rational discussion. There are these knee-jerk reactions kick in. And so this is a terrible dilemma for those of us who still operate according to, you know, reading, discussion, give due importance to factual basis. Maybe my facts are, you know, you could demonstrate that my facts are weak here or there, or you could bring other facts to the table. But this is not how politics has been done. This is not how the mass media of our time operates. It's a minority of people who operate according to, you know, reasonable discussion. It's mostly, as you say, this mythological world, which really isn't real, but as long as people perceive it's real and it gives them some comfort, they can watch television and sort of feel, well, I can, you know, I can, on the game shows, I can identify with all these riches that this person on television is getting, and maybe I won't notice my own situation is, you know, increasingly intolerable. Maybe it'll give me some escape. People are, you know, are addicted to substances, legal and illegal. Television is a kind of drug in its own way. People are stressed financially. Very few people are in a position to really devote a great, you know, time and attention and reading to figuring out what's actually going on. And the big system seems to be playing on that, seems to be exploiting that.
And, Professor, in my own work, I've provided a lot of coverage of America's barbaric adventures in unlimited detention and torture in the name of this so-called war on terror. And in more particular, it's a war on so-called Islamic extremists. And we have the irony that one of the most popular television shows during the Bush-Cheney era was a show called 24, which revolves around a character who is a warrior who uses torture, and they exploit these far-fetched ticking time bomb scenarios. And at the same time, Americans turned a blind eye intentionally to what was really going on at Guantanamo Bay, at Abu Ghraib, what continues to this day, at Bagram and other black sites in Afghanistan. And they are so willing to believe our own propaganda about American nationalism and how, you know, we are the good guys in all of these battles that we have engaged in. And yet we have this situation where Obama, I think with good intentions on day two, tried to close Guantanamo, and he was blocked.
And you have a Canadian in there, Omar Khadr, a child soldier.
Indeed, who is put before one of these kangaroo courts. It's been delayed, but it will resume here shortly. The so-called military commissions and information extracted from torture and also extracted from other those other prisoners being held there under duress is being used against this young man. And they have taken his actions, alleged actions, in a combat zone and criminalized them because it's alleged that they were directed against Americans. And so we have a real irrational set of beliefs and values in this country. And people are willing to watch torture as entertainment, and at the same time, they're willing to rationalize it because somehow they think it makes them safer.
Well, let's put this in perspective. This is not entirely new. The School of the Americas, mm-hmm, in Georgia,
Fort
has
Benning,
been teaching torture, covert assassinations to officials, people who are going to take over important positions in Latin America. So we know that U.S. has been involved in torture and teaching its officials and teaching its puppet regimes and their officials how to do torture for some time. And let's also consider, you know, the prison, the reality that U.S. is exporting this culture of prison and incarcerating in large numbers of peoples. The prison system in the United States, I worked closely with Splitting the Sky, who attempted a citizen's arrest of George W. Bush, and he was involved at Attica in 1971, where 43 prisoners were killed. And there were intolerable conditions in that Attica prison and other prisons to forced the issue to that point that the inmates took over the prison. And, you know, he talks a great deal about what it was like in prison in those days. Now the prison population has expanded hugely, so that the United States incarcerates the largest percentage of its own people at a higher rate than any other country, with the possible exception of Rwanda, and we know what happened there. And you know, this isn't done equitably. It's largely black people who are disproportionately incarcerated. So, I mean, you think if you're black in the United States and you lost those union jobs in Detroit, well, maybe you can get a job in these dark sites, these black sites where people are tortured and killed. So this is intolerable. You say, well, we're not the Nazis, surely, but, you know, yes, the United States has concentration camps, and we don't know how many, and we don't really know who's in them. And you know, part of this whole psychology of the war on terror is, well, you know, by virtue of having these places with Arab people with Arab names inside in great numbers, it seems to give credence that, oh yes, there are terrorists out there. What does this word terrorist mean? But the idea that we would throw overboard principles like innocent till proven guilty and say, yeah, it's okay for the President of the United States to designate anybody as an unlawful enemy combatant, put them in prison, torture them. Al-Libi, you know, who was talking about how, you know, he was tortured in order to put the finger on Khalid Sheikh, Muhammad Khalid Sheikh, and then he dies. So from Uzbekistan, we get the British ambassador telling us that they're just rounding up anybody and everybody and torturing them and saying, say you're Al-Qaeda, say you're Al-Qaeda.
And Professor, let me just interject that I have followed the issues of Guantanamo quite carefully. The peak population was 774, and so far 600 of those have been released without charge, and we can impute from that they are innocent of any direct relationship to the terrorism that was alleged by Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld when these were labeled the worst of the worst, who should never, ever again see the light of day.
And imagine the psychological things that they've been put through. And have they been transformed into so-called assets? Is that what has really been going on? To send them away and transform them into snitches for the national security state? How can you find words to describe the appalling, abysmal condition that we're in, where this is made to seem normal, this is made to seem acceptable? It only can be that our minds have been, or many people's minds have been, contaminated to such an extent that no longer can we imagine certain populations as really being people, really being human beings. This finessing of the concept of the terrorist, the Arab terrorist, the Muslim terrorist, you know, this has become an icon that has been exploited to keep alive this permanent war economy that we began the discussion with, and to expand it. And it's so large now that it overwhelms pretty much every other part of the economy, and the political power that goes with it, an unaccountable power, is, because it's covert, is unimaginable almost.
You talk about seeing this anti-imperial current as the other side of the current imperial initiative. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, well, in Canada, I looked very closely at Tecumseh, who created a pan-Indian confederacy to fight the expansion of the United States. And he was basically saying the United States is paying off and bribing certain of our chiefs, dividing us, paying under the table here and there, knocking a few of us off here and there. We have to join together and form a confederacy of peoples. And maybe with British assistance, we can make some kind of stand and create a polity that would be recognized internationally. Think of Nasser attempting to create a pan-Arab identity, or Nkrumah or Patrice Lumumba with this concept of a pan-African identity. So as imperialism expands, first European imperialism, but then the U.S. seems to move into the vacuum and informally take over these the activities of these European empires, you have to, in order to resist this, you have to kind of imagine yourself in larger and larger ways. And I mentioned the Bandung Conference in 1955. So this process of trying to create larger alliances and confederacies, I connect this with the concept of the fourth world. This I call anti-imperial globalization. So imperial globalization begets since 1492 this other trajectory in history, which where people don't accept to have their resources stolen and their languages preempted, and they seek to resist. But in order to resist, they can't resist as isolated communities. They have to create larger and larger alliances. They have to globalize. And we have to do this on the planet. We have to find those of us, you know, who deplore the concept that the end of history would end with this sort of corporate capitalism as a monoculture of the world, as the dominant and only available political economy of the world. You know, we have to find ways to ally ourselves, to confederate, to transcend various kinds of borders, whether they be political borders, religious borders, ideological borders. We have to globalize our activities. Trade unions can't operate, for instance, you know, totally within the framework of a single nation state. Trade unions have to become far more transnational. So that's what I mean by anti-imperial globalization.
And Professor, in closing, I'd like you to help our listeners understand your concept of the bowl with one spoon. And let me start with this quote from your book. "The image of the bowl with one spoon serves as a symbol of the public interest that emerges from the Indian country of Canada. In Canada, the Anglo-American tradition of making treaties with indigenous peoples has never been preempted. The Aboriginal provisions of the Royal Proclamation are being renewed in British Columbia and elsewhere in treaty negotiations with First Nations that continue until this day. The higher ideals of this tradition of intercultural diplomacy have not always been well understood or respected. Nevertheless, this continuing heritage offers the world a North American example of an approach to human interaction that eschews the extremes of conquest and embraces instead a broader vision of the public interest and the public good."
Yes. The bowl with one spoon is a symbol on wampum that says shared hunting territory. If a people make different peoples make a treaty and say, we're going to share hunting territory, they would signify this with an image of a bowl with one spoon. The Indian Confederacy of Tecumseh used this symbol, as I say, in the Pan-Indian Confederacy. And it, as I was looking at General Motors, which, of course, is based in Detroit initially, and thinking about the nationalization of General Motors in the financial debacle, it occurred to me, why couldn't we embrace this concept that we nationalize General Motors, that in the crisis we're in environmentally, where we're trying to transform, you know, transportation and energy in ways that are less taxing on the environment, on the climate of the earth, that this can't be just left entirely to the market. So why don't we use General Motors as a flagship for the bowl with one spoon, for shared interest, for communal interest? Since Reagan, Thatcher era, you know, we were sort of instructed, government bad, business good. We should privatize more and more of the commons. And look where it led. It led to the financial debacle, and taxpayers have been asked to throw in our collective wealth to bail out the banks. Why can't we get with our collective wealth some good assets rather than these toxic assets? Why can't we speak in terms of the public interest, the public good, the common good? We need to find ways to reintroduce these concepts. I suppose John F. Kennedy said, you know, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do and us can do collectively for our country and these days for the world. To find a way to reinvigorate and re-legitimize the public sector, the public interest, the common good, the bowl with one spoon. That's how I complete the book.